An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire, and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-yi-yo!
Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Network.
Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky. All the horses snorting fire. As they ride on, hear their cry.
Nobody does it any better than Johnny Cash. I'll be back in a moment with your phone calls. And my, oh, my, oh, my, the lines are already jammed. Joshua Warren, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua, the investigations that you've done, you bring this equipment and you have this group of people who do the work. Did you have to train them? I mean, how long does it take for people to do that? Can anybody do this?
Well, I usually don't train people as much as I look for people who already have expertise in a particular field. I mean, basically what we do is all based on the scientific method, and if someone understands that method and knows how to use it, then they can just take whatever experience that person already has using whatever technology they specialize in and apply that to the operation. But paranormal investigation is about documenting as much as possible at a particular site and then using that information to rule out the conventional and look for what is left over, since that is presumably what's going to be paranormal.
What have you learned about the universe since you've been investigating ghosts?
That is a big question, George. Let's see, what have I learned about the universe? Well, I guess I would say that the biggest thing that comes to mind right off the bat is that that we are in a very complicated situation when we try to document something without interfering with what we are documenting. It's the old Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, the idea that when you are there observing something, by simply being there observing it, you change it to a certain degree. And that's why that you get all these reports about, reports from people telling you about these amazing things they've seen. And then you might go to whatever location or put yourself in whatever situation they describe with a group of 10 people and not see anything or experience anything like that person described, but it may simply be because you have changed that whole situation by bringing a team of observers in. And so I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've seen time and time again. That may be the quintessential problem that we have in documenting a lot of this stuff. It happens when the conditions are whatever are aside from the conditions you have when you bring a team in. So that's the hard part.
Let's go to the phones. Not a lot of time left. This hour is going to take off. First time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
Thank you. Spokane, Washington.
Okay, go ahead, please.
I'm interested in knowing your theory behind experiencing an entity in your dream, like recurring dreams, as in like somebody has passed and you experienced them in your dreams.
That's a very good question. Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I should also mention that even though I approach all of this research that I do as objectively as possible, I myself am a person who has dreams that come true often. And so to me, that's proof for me personally of psychic phenomena existing. I have premonitions and dreams, very specific dreams that come true. I have never personally had a dream where, you know, a deceased person has come to me, but I have no reason to doubt the legitimacy of that because I hear about those experiences often. And I do know that the human body, not to mention the human brain, is obviously receptive to some type of energy that we cannot measure and detect with our current technology. That's why we can't figure out what that mind-body connection is all about. How do your thoughts control your body? Mm-hmm. And so knowing that the brain is tuned to a frequency that is very special and unique, I have no doubt that if indeed there are people who can come back from the other side to communicate with us, they would have a much better chance of doing it when you are sleeping, because when you're awake, you're just distracted by so much. I mean, it's incredible, all the bombardment that we receive every second from all of our senses. And so when we are sleeping, at least you've taken, you know, I guess, 50% maybe of that distraction away. I find it very interesting that when they hook people's brains up to monitors, that they can't tell the difference in terms of how the brain reacts to something it's seeing and something it's imagining. So what's happening inside your head is really no different than what's happening outside your head, because really it all happens inside your head. And so yes, if you have had an experience or you think experiences occur where, you know, a spirit has come to you while you're sleeping, that's a very legitimate phenomenon. It happens frequently. Just recently, a guy told me that he had been awoken in the middle of the night by the spirit of his father coming to him in his sleep, telling him his house was on fire. And because of that, he and his wife were able to save their lives. And so, yeah, that's, you know, sleeping and dreaming is one of the most mysterious things that we encounter on this planet, and it certainly is very open to the possibility of some type of interaction with a ghost.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I appreciate you being on the program. You know, the dream manifestations, as you pointed out, Joshua, may or may not be true. They could be merely dreams, or they could be a mechanism for the spirit to try to visit someone. It could be either one. I guess we really don't know, though, what it is, do we?
No, that's the hard part, because if we know that you can look at, you know, a vase in front of you, and it stimulates certain parts of your brain, and then you can close your eyes and imagine that vase, and it stimulates the same parts of the brain, then the first question is, well, how do we differentiate the external from the internal? And then once we take it to the internal, how do we differentiate one thing that has an internal manifestation based upon something you've experienced versus something you are imagining? And so, yeah, that's really the core of it all. I mean, the greatest mystery that we have here on this planet. I don't care if you're studying ghosts or UFOs or Bigfoot or whatever. The biggest mystery is, what is this thing that we call the observer? You know, what is this thing inside of our heads that allows us to experience life? And then how do we differentiate those things that we can create from those things that are based upon some external input? And so if we could ever figure that one out.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, that would be the key.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. Hello there.
Hey, good morning, George. How you doing?
Good morning. Welcome to the program. Where are you calling from, by the way?
This is Jim from Wichita.
All right, Jim, go ahead. It's all yours.
Hey, good morning, Josh. See, I just have a story I'd like to share with you. This happened to me when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I was living in Manassas, Virginia, which is, we live probably about a half mile from Bull Run and the Battlefield Park and all that. And it was a real, as you well know, intense Civil War area. And my parents at the time were messing around, I guess, with a Ouija board. I was not aware of this at the moment. But they contacted, I guess, the spirit of a Civil War soldier and invited him into the house. And everything started going weird from that point on. For about 4.5 years, I lived with this spirit. And the spirit seemed to really focus in on me more than my brother. But also my brother experienced some things. I'll share with you some of the stuff that happened to me personally. On an ongoing basis, about 1 o'clock in the morning generally, I would wake up from a sound sleep, and the whole house would be spinning. I mean, literally spinning like it was on a giant merry-go-round. And I would get up from my bunk bed. I was on the top bunk, and I'd run into my parents' room, and I'd be sitting on their bed, and I'd be crying and yelling and saying, "The house is spinning again. The house is spinning again." And my parents would be like, "No, it's not. No, it's not. You're just dreaming." I'm like, "No, I'm not. I'm wide awake." And all of a sudden, just like that, it would just stop. And I just walk back into my bedroom, and I go back to bed. And this happened, I can't even tell you how many times this happened to me. Other times, there was like things would end up disappearing in the house, and I would search the house high and low, closets everywhere, looking for this item. And then all of a sudden, like a week or two later, I'd open a door, and it'd be sitting right there in plain view. And there was times I heard voices, like I'd walk in the house and after school, and I'd be the only one in the house, and I'd get this chill up the back of my neck, like someone was right behind me, and there was like this cold breath on my neck, and the hair would stand up on the back of my neck, and I'd hear like this whispering in my ear real quick, and you really couldn't distinguish what was being said, but it was just like a real quick whispering. And I know, I mean, I'd have goosebumps on my flesh and everything, and I'd be like, knowing something was there, but I never seen it. And I used to hear footsteps walking on our hardwood floors up in the master bedroom. I mean, just a bunch of weird, weird stuff. And
we're losing you. We lost him, Josh, right at the end. Too bad. It was on the tail end of a good story.
Hopefully, but he didn't whirl off into the other world.
Right through another dimension.
Right.
Well, you know what? These experiences, though, are happening to so many people. I mean, if you had to take this into a court of law, could you prove that ghosts exist just on these testimonies?
Well, according to the definition that I used, they certainly do exist because they are real at very least in terms of the human experience. And we cannot discount the human experience. Now, if we are going to say, is there objective evidence that the spirits of dead people still come back and exist in this world, then no. There is no proof for that, legal or otherwise. But the very fact that people have these experiences shows that if you define a ghost in terms of the human experience, then ghosts do exist. And that's probably one of the reasons that it's sort of hard to understand some of the classification systems for this, because if you're looking at the human experience, you have to deal with human interpretation. And what one person might call a ghost, another person might call a demon, or another person might call an alien, or an optical illusion. And so that's why the objective aspect is important for us to be able to manage this stuff systematically and scientifically, but certainly ghosts do exist.
Do you ever, when you're doing, when you're writing, when you're doing an investigation, do you ever get stories of the old hag?
Mm-hmm.
You do?
Yeah, once in a while. They are not common. I've heard it discussed on your show a few times, and it seems like a lot of people refer to the old hag in connection with the sleep paralysis phenomenon. Have you found that as well, George?
Yes, it's very close.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's directly related, sometimes not, but you're right.
Yeah, and of course sleep paralysis is pretty well understood according to most scientists that study sleep. I mean, and I'm not a person who's ever monitored someone while he or she is sleeping and dreaming, but from what I understand, you know, they're, well, when you go to sleep, you know, part of your brain shuts down so that when you dream about running the marathon, you don't start actually running the marathon. And so it makes sense that a part of your body would be paralyzed and that maybe, you know, part of your body would wake up while the rest of it is still shut down. And it just takes a while for you to recover. But now the aspect of having some kind of an apparition there, and the old hag is sort of a general term for, well, in some cases it's an alien, in some cases it's an old, creepy-looking person or whatever. That sort of plays to this idea that a part of you is awake and a part of you is still asleep and dreaming. And that area is just so complex. I mean, this boundary between being awake and being asleep and dreaming, that I don't know how we can even come close to grasping that with our technology. I mean, when people are wide awake and they have an experience, that's one thing. Even that's complicated enough. But when they're in that boundary of sleep and semi-sleep or whatever, I mean, we really can't come close to understanding what that means right now.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Welcome, welcome. Oh, that's me. Oh, sorry. Hello, George.
Go ahead. Thanks.
How you doing? George, my name is Axel, and I'm here in...
Axel Rose, no doubt?
That's what your guy said. I was born and raised in Cuba. I'm one of those boat people. I left when I was 18 years old.
Ah, okay.
I remember reading the Sputnik magazine, was from the old Soviet Union, was a magazine where they, you know, put all the weird stuff and stuff like that. And I remember reading an article of a scientist fleet that went to the Triangle, and one of their ships lost the entire crew. I mean, you know, the sister ship went, you know, on top of the ship, and they found cigarettes lit and food on plates on top of the tables, everything that normal. There was no struggle, nothing out of place. Everything was normal, but there was no crew.
Right, they were all gone. And there was theories that pirates come and kidnap them. Probably not, because pirates want the ship. They don't really care about the people.
Yeah, exactly. And you would see blood, and you would see shooting or something like that, but everything was in complete order. Like,
yes.
There was just nobody.
Did you hear of that case, Joshua?
I don't recall that specific case.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but you know, the first thing that I think of when I hear that is that if we are to set aside conventional explanations like, oh, maybe they were kidnapped by pirates or whatever. I mean, if we're to set that stuff aside, you know, organisms have such a unique physical makeup from an energy perspective. In fact, I've done experiments over the years with using organisms as antennas. You know, you use plants as antennas, which sort of tie into some of the Baxter effect phenomena, for example, or even using people as antennas. And human beings or anything organic have such a unique makeup. It goes even beyond frequency. And I would think that if there were a warp-type phenomenon, similar to what we were talking about earlier, that is able to shift some spectrums of matter from one phase to another phase, it's certainly possible that the organic matter could be shifted, whereas inorganic matter would not be, because it's such a vastly different phase of existence. And, you know, it's a long shot scientifically to say that that's what's happened, because we really don't have any sort of basis for that in a laboratory with repeatable controlled experiments and so on. But I do think when it comes to some of these cases like that, or like the lost colony that I mentioned, the first settlement the English put here off the coast of North Carolina, where the people vanished, it very well could be something along those lines, where the organisms, the organic part is shifted and the rest is not.
Stay with us. We'll wrap up with final phone calls in a moment with our guest Joshua Warren. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles.
This part of the show, listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Oh, yeah. If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play, never see you when deliberately you put me in my way. Well, here's a poke at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles.
Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To reach George from west of the Rockies, dial 800-618-8255. From east of the Rockies, dial 800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach George by dialing area code 818-501-4721. International callers may reach George by dialing your in-country Sprint access number and pressing option 5. Then dialing toll-free, 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Well, if you get a minute, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the images under Joshua's name that he supplied to us. Once those pictures come up, scroll down to the torture chamber. That is one weird picture. We're going to talk with him about the hauntings that occur there when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. This picture, the torture chamber, Joshua, can you tell us a little bit about this place in Nassau?
Absolutely. Well, of course, last Halloween when we did our paranormal expedition to the Bahamas to investigate pirate ghosts, one of the places that we were told we should certainly visit was Fort Fincastle. And, of course, for many years, the island of Nassau in particular was a hive for pirates. In fact, Blackbeard himself declared himself governor of Nassau for quite a while until he was finally run off. Hmm. And that particular room that you see there was their interrogation chamber. And sort of a euphemism for, I'm sure, what went on in that room. Lots of battles were fought around it as well. But when our team arrived at Fort Fincastle, people time after time would walk into this small black room. And I mean, it was so dark that you could not see your hand in front of your face, even though the sun was blazing outside. And immediately turn around and walk out and say, I cannot be in that room. And we're not talking about psychics or people who are sensitive. I mean, even I myself, who I do not consider myself a psychic, even though I think everybody has some degree of sensitivity, I'd walk into that small stone room, and you talk about a shudder running down your spine and the hair standing up on the back of your neck. I mean, it was absolutely uncanny. But being the scientist that I am, I pushed through that and spent about an hour there in my first session with my meters registering fields. And the first thing that I found outstanding was we knew there was nothing there that should produce any type of an electromagnetic field. And yet there was this swirling mass of electromagnetism, very tumultuous, at an unnatural frequency inside there that was moving. It was a transient field. And one of our investigators, named Casey Fox, can see the aura. We've actually tested him by taking him and placing him on one side of a blinder and having people on the other side, and he can tell you the position of the person on the opposite side of the blinder by seeing that person's aura extending over the top of the blinder. So it's a pretty objective measurement of whether or not he can see
sure
this
is.
Thing.
Yeah.
So he was in there with me, and he, right off the bat, walked in and said, I don't understand this, but for some reason, there is a little boy here. And he would say, little boy standing right over there. And I would take my meters and put them over there, and right where he said the little boy was, the meters would max out, and then they would die off. And he'd say, okay, now he's over here. And every time he pointed to a position, I was able to confirm it. Well, then Casey finally said, this is too much for me. I'm getting out of here. And he left. Well, about 5-10 minutes later, another woman on the expedition came in, had supposedly no interaction with Casey whatsoever, and she walked in and said, oh, my goodness, I can see a little boy right here. And same thing, she could tell me time and time again exactly where to place my devices, and consistently, not only was I picking up energy wherever she would point out, but people there taking pictures were getting a variety of anomalies exactly where she said they were, and all of a sudden she said, oh my goodness, there is a very scary, big, dark guy here, and I'm out of here, and she left. And so, these folks were able to obviously see something that I could not see, even though my equipment was detecting it, even though the cameras were picking up anomalies. Why there was a little boy there, I can't tell you, but to make what could be a long story rather short, it was one of those places where there were so many layers of history and so much pain and agony that had been shoveled on that you'd step in that and you would cross the threshold into something that was very heavy and basically claustrophobic.
Well, I'm telling you, the picture is eerie all by itself. Let's go to the phones again, Joshua. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for holding so long.
Hey, no problem. Hi, my name's Alan. I'm from Calgary, Alberta. Greetings from Canada.
Greetings, Alan. Go ahead.
I've got a comment and a question. I'll go with my comment first because my question's kind of detailed. From what I've heard, most of the research that's been done in the Bermuda Triangle has all been directed downward, correct? Checking the waters and whatnot?
Yes.
What if there's something either extra-dimensional or somehow masked to our to our instrumentation that we have available to us above the Bermuda Triangle. Just a thought. My question that I have is, I talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people have, you know, the one or two, the aunt, the uncle that's had some kind of weird experience. Well, in my family, it's everybody. And everybody's had two or three incidents. Like me, myself, I've had two out-of-body experiences and I've seen a UFO. What I'm wondering is, is my family somehow, like, more sensitive or something, or retracting something, or something like that? I don't know. It's weird.
Now, that's a great point, Alan, and I can relate to that very much. I would say one of the reasons that I've been so interested in this type of activity my entire life is because I have one of those families as well. It might just be because my family is very big. I mean, on my father's side, there were 7 children. On my mother's side, there were 10 children. And so you have a lot of people growing up and experiencing life at the same time. And, I mean, I could tell you stories that go back to certainly the early 1900s. And so it does bring up a variety of questions. Is it because that some people genetically have more of a sensitivity? Is it because that some families genetically have a bigger imagination? Or is it that there is something about these people that is of interest to beings from some realm that we don't understand? And those are, and that's a big suggestion. That's a big question right there. The fact is, I have seen time and time again this pattern of families that do have a higher propensity to have paranormal experiences. The reason for that is something that, frankly and honestly, I can only speculate on. But it does make me wonder if there is something about certain types of people that are of interest to this other realm, and maybe it is because of our sensitivity. And that's probably an area that has really never been thoroughly studied, because it's a pretty big project, and in fact, that's probably a project that I should look into at some point. I think there'd be a lot of interest there, but ultimately, I don't have a good answer for you, but you are indeed correct when it comes to this perception that some families have a stronger connection to observance of paranormal phenomena.
Could be hereditary. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dan from Hendersonville, North Carolina.
Sure,
hello,
Dan.
George. Hello,
good to
Joshua.
Talk with you.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, you know why I'm calling?
Oh, I think I might have a clue.
I'm not going to let you get off the air without telling the Leicester cattle mutilation story that's never been heard.
That's right. That's a good one. I appreciate that. Dan is a friend of mine, and he'd emailed me saying that we should talk about this, and I think we should, because I very seldom have the opportunity to come into any kind of contact with cattle mutilations. It's just not an area that happens. Well, it's not a phenomenon that happens a lot in my neck of the woods here in West North Carolina. But nonetheless, last year, there was a cattle mutilation episode, or I guess you could call it sort of an epidemic, really, that occurred in one of the most remote areas here in the mountains, out in Madison County. And for several weeks, you know, these cows very typically were taken down, and there were parts missing in a quite surgical manner and so on. And it didn't get as much attention as you might think that something like that would get. But what made it outstanding for us is that one of our investigators on the team is really interested in anything involving animals. He's really our sort of resident cryptozoologist, Micah Hanks. And Micah started checking into it. And when the law enforcement officials began investigating this, the first thing they did was bring in some experts from certain organizations in the area who specialize in animals. And one lady who was one of these experts told Micah, "Look, I'm not supposed to talk about this, but I'm just going to tell you," and started up this long, you know, relationship with him that lasted, you know, quite a while giving him the tell, saying that there is a cover-up going on here, that the cops are trying to say that this cattle mutilation is the product of dogs. The dogs had come out of nowhere and done this, but she said there is absolutely no way. This was done by dogs or any other animal around here.
A dog is not a neat killer.
No, not at all. And she said clearly this was either done by humans or something on the same level of intelligence as humans, and she could not figure out for the life of her why there was an active cover-up going on. Now, the most likely explanation, of course, when it comes to these cases, is that indeed you do have some kind of a cover-up that is, some kind of an activity that humans are out there perpetrating. You know, some sickos are out there cutting up cows for fun. But I have heard other reports, which I've never had the opportunity to confirm, about people going to the site of these cattle mutilations and finding electromagnetic fields and things like that existing residually on the bodies. And if that's the case, I certainly cannot explain that at all. But this whole cattle mutilation thing, it deserves a great deal of investigation, knowing that I have seen personally the correspondence between this woman who was brought in and asked to be a part of this cover-up. I have her emails right here on my computer to this day. And it's very disturbing to me to think that something like cows being mutilated in a remote area there is being covered up by the people who are out there representing us publicly in law enforcement. Why is this happening? Why do they not want to get to the bottom of it? What is the interest behind them? Is it the government? Are they testing these things to see if there's some type of contaminant there? Or is there some greater conspiracy? I wish I knew more about it. I've been trying to get access to some of this information, considering it happened so close to me, but it is sealed tight. So don't know that much more about it.
It is strange. I'll tell you, we've got our reporter, Linda Moulton Howe. She's done some great work in that arena, and there's just something very peculiar going on. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Joshua Warren. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ricky. I'm calling you from California. And
Ricky, welcome.
640. Good talking to you, George. Joshua, I'm actually from the Outer Banks area out in Beaufort, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up back there, and it's beautiful, beautiful country back there. I actually took a trip 32 years ago. I took a trip to, when I was 15 years old, took a drive with some friends of mine. Obviously, I didn't drive. But we went down to Wilmington. And we went searching for the Mako light, and I went down to the trestle down there and walked all the way down, didn't see anything. Then some people were standing at a certain position when we got back and said, if we want to see the light, you have to stand here, and you'll see it. And I saw it. Do you have any research on that, or do you know anything about that?
I sure do, and I'm very happy that you brought that up because it ties perfectly into some of the things we've discussed tonight. And for those who don't know, the Mako light is this sphere of light that has been seen for many, many years moving around these railroad tracks in Wilmington. And the story is that some railroad worker's head was cut off, and you can still see his lantern being carried around to this day on the tracks. And what I have found is that you frequently have these kinds of stories about unexplainable illuminations being seen around railroad tracks. And I think the explanation ties right into our work regarding the Brown Mountain Lights, that a railroad track is just a big, long conductor, just a big piece of metal there laid down on the earth. And the earth is an extremely electrodynamic system. And people see lights around railroad tracks and streams because those are the areas where the electricity from the earth is concentrated. And we always have this idea of electricity coming from the atmosphere down to the earth, but it comes right out of the earth back to the atmosphere as well. A lot of people don't realize that. And from what I understand, a few years ago, they removed that section of railroad tracks, and since then, the Mako light has not been seen again. So I do think the Mako light was most likely a form of plasma, just like we're getting at Brown Mountain. It's a ball of light that is the product of numerous electrostatic discharges coming off of those tracks and intersecting. And at that point over the tracks where they intersect, they begin to spin, build up a point of momentum. And when it spins fast enough, you can see that pop up into the visible electromagnetic spectrum as a ball of light, and then other times it drops back down into the infrared and so on and so forth. But it indeed seems to be something very similar to ball lightning that just moves back and forth along those railroad tracks when the conditions are right for discharge to occur.
All right, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hey, my name's Caitlin, and I'm from Destin. My husband grew up in South Florida, and this is going back to the Bermuda Triangle. Are you with me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, when he was a teenager, his dad took him and his brother out on an outing, which they did go on a lot of boat trips. But the engine died on their boat, and they were in the Bermuda Triangle, and they were out in the middle of nowhere, and they've all described a very bizarre mist that they were surrounded by, but at the same time, there was debris. They were surrounded by debris in the water, and they were in the middle of nowhere, but there was debris, like boat seats, wood, life preservers, and they were stuck out there for about 2 hours until their dad was finally able to get the boat going, and they were able to get out. But it was just strange, the mist and all that, you know, why all that debris was there. And they've always been mystified by that.
Well, right off the bat, I don't know of anything specific about the Bermuda Triangle area that would explain why that debris would be there. Now, of course, it's sort of interesting to think that maybe one of these ships that at one point disappeared actually got, ground up in some manner and spit back out into the sea. But now the myth that you're talking about is something that I've heard quite a few times. Pilots and sea captains talk about seeing this mist. And the main thing that I think of when it comes to that is ionization. Whenever you have a large amount of electrical energy in the air, the air becomes ionized, and it can create atmospheric effects like a mist, a greenish fog or a bluish fog. And so, we were talking earlier about how that there might be a warp-type phenomena that occurs when, the energy is at a certain level that maybe shifts our realm so that it interacts with another realm, and that might be a byproduct, getting this misty appearance from the electrical ions.
All right, Joshua, the clock has got us, my friend. You take care and be in touch with us, okay?
Thank you, George.
Joshua Warren, you need any information on what he does, you can go to his website or sites, because there are a couple of them right now linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Nikki Mbornoni, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, be safe, everyone.